This is a story about how one song kept alive the hopes of freedom for millions of people who felt they were being held captive by the old Soviet Union. Artur Talvik is a filmmaker in Estonia. Even when he was small, he knew that the ideas of an independent Estonia that were embedded in the song were both subversive and delightful.
It's a kind of dream about this independent and free country where you can live without this regime. And suddenly you imagine that like thousands of other people have seen also the same kind of dream. It's like you're getting high off that.
How one song helped keep political dreams alive. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
While Estonians successfully regained their independence from the Soviet Union 17 years ago, the tug of war still continues over nations that were once part of the Eastern Bloc. Just this morning, two former Soviet republics, Ukraine and Georgia, were told they will not be welcomed into NATO.
The imagery will not sit well with Moscow. U.S. President George W. Bush in the former Soviet Republic of Ukraine, standing shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine's President Viktor Yushchenko.
And for as long as Russia mutters about the westernization of its former republics, no one rests easy. Artur Talvik is an Estonian filmmaker who grew up under Soviet rule. Allegiance to the USSR was not something to be questioned or challenged.
As a school children, most of the children were members of Red October Children and the Pioneer, which is between Communist Youth Party and the Red October Children.
Do you remember wearing the uniform of the Children of Red October? Do you remember wearing this red neck scarf?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And also we had a kind of songs about Lenin and songs about how great Soviet Union is and etc. So, you know, the radish where cover is red and inside is white. The Estonian people were something like that. They pretend, so did I, pretend that, we are communists, But inside they were absolutely against it.
Did any of it stick, though, Artur? Did any of this propaganda stick? When you were a small child, did you believe at any time that Lenin was a great man and the savior of the country?
No, this I can absolutely guarantee. We didn't believe, and my friends didn't believe. And in North Estonia, we got this possibility to watch Finnish TV, and it was kind of window to the Western world for us. And therefore, we knew what the world is, actually, so we're not really blind. And our parents, they told what Estonia was, and the real hope for independence was still alive.
Was it risky for your parents to speak openly about Estonia and independence?
It was risky when you did it publicly. Talking about Soviet Union and making jokes about Soviet Union, it was very common in our families. But there was a really difference between the people. I mean, those people whose relatives were deported to Siberia, for example, they were much more afraid than, for example, our family. So for us, Western world was the thing we really dreamed about.
You had to speak Russian, though, in school, didn't you?
Early 80s, the Soviet Union started to force us to use more Russian language. So they started to Russify more bureaucracy and also to bring in Russian language. So we spoke Estonian, but almost everyone knew Russian language as well. But it was still like a second language.
There's one song that sticks in my head from that time. It's the very sort of formal dun 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 dun
dun dun dun dun. Союз неразделимых республик народных. Da 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 da. Yes, we were supposed to learn this, yes.
But did that song have any meaning for you, or was it just something that you were told to do by your teachers?
Usually we make jokes about this, and we did our own words for that, but it was something we were forced to learn, and it was easier to learn it than to fight against it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Artur Talvik says that singing the Soviet national anthem was like taking medicine. But there was another song that was something of a secret antidote for Estonians. For more than a century, Estonians had gathered every 5 years for a huge song festival. Thousands of singers on stage with thousands more in the audience. Artur was 15 years old the first time he sang in one of those choruses. And back then, the Soviet Union had very strict rules about what could and could not be sung.
We were supposed to sing the songs which were about the Soviet Union and about Big Lenin. And then there were kind of neutral songs. And in the end of this festival, after the official program was over, we always sang a song called Mu Isamaa on Minu Arm. My homeland is my love. It's kind of wonder how the Soviets allowed us to sing this song. And usually they stopped when people wanted to sing it several times. So as soon as one time was sang, they stopped it. Or they did also that they turned off the loudspeakers. But the choir was so big and powerful. So even without loudspeakers, we were able to sing it very, very powerfully. Everybody knew that this song means something special for Estonians. But of course, in the lines, there wasn't mentioned Estonia as a country separately. And it was so that you can explain for Soviets, this is a song about homeland, Soviet Union. But actually, it was a song about Estonia, and it was very deep in our hearts, this song.
Can you tell me what any of the lyrics of the song are in English? Do any of them translate?
My homeland is my love, to whom I've given my heart. To you I sing my greatest happiness, my flowering homeland. Your pain boils in my heart. Your pride and joy makes me happy. My fatherland, my fatherland.
Can you sing us just a little bit of it?
I try. Mu isamaa on minu arm, kel südant annud ma, sul laulan ma, mu ülemõnn, mu õitsev Eestimaa. Sul laulan ma, mu ülemõnn, mu õitsev Eestimaa. It's a little miracle. This song is a little miracle. And to sing this song during the Soviet regime so very openly, it is something you can't forget till the end of your life. It's very extreme and very powerful emotion. Most of people were crying, and probably I got tears in my eyes as well. It's a kind of dream about this independent and free country where you can live without this regime. And suddenly you imagine that like thousands of other people have seen also the same kind of dream. And it makes you feel differently, and it's like you're getting high off that. You find some kind of power inside you.
When you sing the song with so many people at the same time, does it lift that fear that you live with? Does it give you a feeling of power that you don't often have when you live under a regime like the Soviet Union?
It gave us hope. And hope was the only thing gave us really alive, or our culture alive. And this song festival was after every 5 years, so it gave us power to live this next 5 years. It sounds very kind of pathetic, but it gave us kind of sign that this nation still lives. And it was also a message to the regime that we haven't forgot that Estonia was independent and we still want this country to be independent.
Well, we know how this part of the story ends. Estonia does get its independence. In fact, it's the pressure from Baltic nations, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, that winds up as key in causing the Soviet Union to unravel. But it was never going to be easy. Estonians like Artur Talvik would face the Soviet tanks before it was over. Artur demonstrated his own independence when he got a Mohawk haircut. And that's when the Soviets were still in firm control. That part of the story is up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. My guest today is the Estonian filmmaker Artur Talvik. He's featured in a new documentary film about this song and the role of this song in keeping alive a spirit of independence in Estonia during the 50 years that people there were forced to belong to the Soviet Union. When Artur was a teenager, he and his friends loved getting under the skin of the Soviet authorities. Despite Moscow's attempt to control information, these kids had learned about punk rock. One day, Artur and his friend decided to get Mohawk haircuts.
We went first to the male barbershop and we asked, would you cut us a Mohawk haircut? And they said, no, it's not on our list. But if you want to do, you can do yourself. We give you a machine and you can make it yourself. Then we said that, we can ruin it. There was one lady who a little bit helped us, but basic thing we did ourselves then.
I don't understand why a Mohawk haircut was banned. Who cared if you had a Mohawk haircut? I mean, here in America, parents might say don't do this, but the state didn't care. Why would it matter in Estonia which way your hair was cut?
The Soviets, they had a kind of image of real Soviet people, which should not look like Western, especially the more radical Western styles. So the saxophone was not allowed suddenly as a Western instrument. There was a probable idea that everybody should be a gray and not think individualistically. They must think in a collective way. And if you think in a collective way, you should look like everybody else. And so the Mohawk haircut was absolutely, they thought it's something like against Soviet Union. But when we wanted to do that, we wanted just to be a little bit punk and a little bit show our protest. And it was already kind of the fashion then.
So what did your mohawk look like?
Skinhead on the left and right side. And then I had maybe 7 centimeters wide line in the middle. And hair there was probably 1 inch high. So we went to a female barbershop. I wanted to paint it green. And then this lady said first that we don't have green hair color in Soviet Union. Then I said, okay, let's paint it red. And suddenly she said that, no, I can't do that. They were afraid that they would get problems if they paint our Mahou haircut. So we did it ourselves, and then we went to the street, and was one and only hotel where the foreigners were allowed to stay. There was a lot of KGB agents around this hotel because they checked, of course, these foreigners, and suddenly they met two guys with Mahou haircuts, and suddenly they ran to us and arrested us. And
hang on a second. They arrested you for having a Mohawk haircut?
Yes, at the hotel. So they didn't took us to a police station or KGB station, but they just arrested there, and they started to write down the information. Like I was supposed to show my passport, and then I was... kind of interrogation, very short one, and they took the information which school we are, and then they wanted to take us to a barber shop to cut off the haircut. But then suddenly something bigger bumped up, or their working day was over or something like that. So they said that we will come to your school on Monday and we'll check that you don't have this anymore.
What happened when you went to school then with this Mohawk haircut?
On Monday, we went to school, and the mistress of school was standing at the front door, and she didn't allow us to go to school. So we were really fighting with her for several hours, and then we thought that, all right, let's go. And we had fun already, so then we went to a barber shop, and we got it off. And then we were like skinheads, but we were allowed to go to school, bald heads.
Did you ever get in
and
trouble?
And the KGB guy, by the way, came to school, not on Monday, but next day. And a week later, we had a big meeting at the school. Some KGB propaganda guys came to our school and started to make a lecture how bad is punk rock. So we had fun.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. By the mid-80s, the Soviet Union had a new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev. With him came glasnost, the promise of open discussion. Well, soon enough, large numbers of Estonians were pushing against even those limits. In 1988, when the Soviet Union still had its military and secret police throughout the country, Estonians called for a demonstration, a concert in the center of a university town. It was an event that gave all participants a new and powerful image of freedom. Artur was there, and he remembers it well. It was one person on the back of a speeding motorcycle who had the courage to unfurl the banned Estonian flag.
The singers of these concerts, they started to sing kind of new songs which were criticizing Soviet Union very strongly, and new songs about independence and the freedom. And the officials, they understood that it's very risky to have these people in the middle of the town singing these songs. So they organized so that they stopped singing party there in the midtown, and then everybody started to move to the same place where we sing this My Homeland, My Love. And all the people who had the sound equipment, they built up very quickly kind of a rock stage, and the audience side is a bit hilly, and suddenly we saw how the motorcycle guy with a big Estonian flag driving on top of this little hill there. Oh, this was great. Oh, great feeling. And this flag was, for us, it was a sign of freedom.
It wasn't too long before others started bringing out their own flags, flags they'd hidden for 50 years. Thousands more people joined the ongoing demonstration. By the time it was over, the festival had lasted nearly a week. Back in Moscow, the hardliners were furious. In August 1991, they staged a coup to remove Gorbachev from power.
Good evening. We still don't know the whereabouts or the condition of Mikhail Gorbachev tonight, but we do know that the Soviet Union is in chaos as there is spreading resistance to the coup by Communist Party conservatives and military leaders. U.S. State Department sources are now saying that some fighting has broken out in the Republic of Latvia, and Soviet troops are moving into other republics as well.
One of those republics was Estonia, where patriots called a special session of the newly formed Congress to declare independence. Now, by this time, Artur Tavik was 27 years old. He was married. He'd started a family. And he was sitting in his apartment that evening when he heard that Soviet tanks were crossing the border.
I was listening for the radio, and I heard that a coup happened in Moscow. And, oh, this frightened me a lot. The army came in, and our people blocked all the roads to main buildings, like a parliament house and TV station and radio station, and construction people, they brought huge concrete blocks, and track drivers, they drove their big trucks to close the street. It looked really like a war. Everybody was listening for the radio or watching for the TV, and the TV was one moment stopped, but the radio still continued, and all the information we got came through radio, and then suddenly they started to call people to come to protect the radio station house and TV station house. I felt myself that I have to go as well, but I was at home with my two little kids. One was 1 year old and the other was 2 years old, and my wife were in another town, and I didn't want to take my little kids with me to this to go to protect the radio house. And first I went to my neighbor lady. I asked to come and babysit my kids, and she said, I can't babysit your kids. I have to come with you. I want to go there and protect the radio as well. Let's go together. I said, who will babysit my kids then? Okay, I called to my mother. Mother started to scream at me. You stupid boy, you want to go and ruin your life there. Probably they kill you, idiot. You have two kids at home. You have to stay. I said, Mama, I have to go there. So she said, okay, but you're still stupid. I'm coming. Okay. So she came and she stayed with my kids. And with this old lady, we went to protect the radio house. And there was pretty many people around there already, and like a couple of hundreds. As soon as we came with this old lady there, it was pretty nice feeling over there. Everybody was singing, and the people from countryside, they brought milk and some products to eat for the people, and somebody came and brought some soup, and very good feeling, and even kind of entertaining feeling. But everybody was listening for the radio, or somebody had a transistor radio with batteries there, and suddenly we got the information that the army started to move. It wasn't a good feeling at all.
Artur, did you guys have any weapons at all?
No. Weapons were so strongly prohibited during the Soviet Union. Of course, we know that people in countryside, some people had guns or rifles, but it was very, very strongly controlled.
This crowd of people is standing there. You have no weapons, and you're looking at Russian soldiers with their armored personnel carriers and their guns, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. And it's extremely stupid to stand against an army without any arms at the front door of a radio station, 100% that you will get at least beaten up, maybe even killed. And it's very frightening. You feel yourself kind of weak there. And then army started to move, and they were pretty close to us, probably like 100 meters away.
Just so I can be clear about this, though, Artur, I mean, you would have known at that time that the Russian soldiers had opened fire on civilians in Lithuania and in Latvia, people who were doing the same thing that you were doing.
And this made standing there even more frightening. So you kind of understood that they're angry and they're in a kind of agony, and they can do, you know, whatever.
And at that moment, Artur, were you frightened? Well, I mean, you're a father at this point.
No, probably this old lady, my neighbor in Grady, was next to me, and I was looking at her, and I thought, this lady stands here and doesn't run away. Why should I go away? And I'm curious to test myself somehow. And I can't say that I'm so patriotic that I will die for my country. But I really like this country, and I really love this country, and I want to protect this country.
Suddenly, though, the Soviet soldiers pulled back. Artur and his elderly neighbor and the others in that human shield stood guard all night. But by the next morning, the new Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, had ordered the army to leave. The crisis was over. Estonia's independence was imminent. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Now, 17 years later, I wondered how Artur explained those days to his now teenage children.
It's very hard to explain what the Soviet Union was. It's so hard to explain them that you haven't had products in the shop. You were supposed to stand in a very long lines to wait for like basic products. Meat was always very long lines, and for fruits, always long lines.
So when the annual song fest is held, do your kids go with you? Do you guys sing that song about your father's land together?
Everybody understands that song festival is something what unites the nation. Even during the days when there is nobody really fight with. And it seems that my kids, they are much more global persons, and for them, they can travel everywhere, and yes, Estonia is home, but kind of new mentality, and they take this country a little bit differently. Maybe when they get a little bit older, they start to understand what's the meaning of this song as well.
You had to fight for your country. Your father had to fight for the independence of Estonia. So did your grandfather. So three generations of your family fought for the idea of Estonia, the hope for independence. But your children have been born, pretty well born, into an independent Estonia. I guess what I mean is, are you worried that because they didn't have to fight for it, maybe they'll never love it the same way that you do?
There is a risk that they will take this country absolutely differently. I mean, there's only 1 million Estonians in the world, and we are a little bit worried that our culture, our language will die.
Do you find sometimes, even today, that you find yourself singing the song? Maybe it's just you in the shower. Maybe you're walking the dog and you're whistling it. I don't know. Does the song still live in your head?
Not like that, but now we had celebration of Estonian independence, and there was a big concert, and kind of spontaneously, in the very end of this concert, people started to sing, and they stood up and started to sing "Mu isamaa on minu arm." Then it really touches you, and probably it sounds stupid that one song touches you and makes you emotionally probably cry, and many people will ask why, and but I can't really answer for that. The song has history in our people's souls, so also in my soul.
Artur Talvik joined me from a studio in the Estonian capital of Tallinn. That's something we wouldn't have been able to do back in the 1960s or the 1970s. Arthur is featured in a new documentary film about the role of music in keeping alive the Estonian spirit of independence. The film is called The Singing Revolution, and it's opening at select theaters across the country. We have a link on our website at thestory.org if you want to look at more information about the film and the Singing Revolution itself. Coming up in just a moment, another place and another time when music takes a prominent place in the debate over politics. The much-admired conservative commentator William F. Buckley Jr. is to be remembered at a church service tomorrow in New York. And in just a moment, I'll talk with one of his close friends, the concert pianist Bruce Levingston, and we'll hear from him about the role of music in the Manhattan Maisonette, where William F. Buckley Jr. invited people to debate politics. That's coming up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Tomorrow, in New York, in St. Patrick's Cathedral, friends and admirers of the late William F. Buckley Jr. will gather for a memorial service. A chance to honor and remember the man whose writing and whose magazine, the National Review, reinvigorated conservative thought in America. William Buckley died about 5 weeks ago. One of the men who'll be there is the concert pianist Bruce Levingston. Although it was fine music and a good friendship that drew Levingston and William Buckley together, it didn't start that way. Bruce was 10 years old, growing up in Mississippi back in the early 70s, when he first heard the voice of William F. Buckley coming from the television.
Account for us the extraordinary paradox that on the one hand, ideology affects to be scientifically establishable. On the other hand, empirical data are at war with ideological presuppositions. The most obvious example of this, I would guess, would be agriculture in the Soviet Union.
I just never heard anyone not only speak with that particular accent, which is a mix of East Coast and Southern and British. He had, you know, Southern relatives.
Uh-huh.
And I just was riveted. And it just the sound, it was like, to me, listening to a kind of music, because he had such a distinctive way of delivering the language. And I ran into my father. I said, "Who is this?" And he said, "Oh, that's William F. Buckley Jr."
Years later, Bruce himself was gaining attention as a pianist. He was in his early 20s and playing a concert in California, a piece by Bach called Chromatic Fantasia and Fugue. After the concert, William Buckley came up to Bruce, introduced himself, and complimented him on his performance. Not long after that, Bruce answered the telephone and heard that voice again.
"Hello, Bruce. Bill Buckley." With that unique accent. "And how would you like to go sailing this weekend?" And I nearly dropped the phone. And I said, "Sure, I'm there." And so group of us went out sailing, and I was, of course, thrilled.
He was an intimidating man, if for no other reason, by force of his vocabulary and his intelligence. Mm-hmm. And he was some decades older than you. Were you nervous when you, walked down the dock towards the sailboat for that excursion?
He was so interested in music. So almost immediately there was an ease between us as friends. One just didn't think about age at all. I also had a deep interest in political matters. So any sense of being nervous around him evaporated if it was there at all.
Tell me about your sailing trip that day.
Martinis were made and lots of good stories were told. And there was even a very small electronic keyboard on board so that...
So you were put to work, were you?
Well, I don't think I had to play on that trip. I played for him, I remember, a little bit before we left from his home at Stamford, Connecticut. and there was the most beautiful room, and his harpsichord was just there jauntily by the window. And so, of course, I played the harpsichord for him. And then once on the boat after dinner, he and one of his friends asked if I played poker. And I said, well, you know, I know how. It's been a while. But I kind of saw them with sparkling eyes looking at one another.
Sizing you up.
Yes. I think they certainly thought they had a mark. And yeah, I'm a Southern boy, so I told the truth. I mean, I didn't know how to play poker, but everybody's having a good time. Out come these chips. And what I didn't know was that they were playing for real. And they were betting it up, and I was feeling bold, and I just bet it up with them.
You thought you were playing with little colored discs of plastic.
Well, something like that, or that at the least it was just a very kind of penny game.
Nickels and dimes, yeah.
That's right. So I noticed as I kept winning some hands, and I noticed that Bill didn't like to fold. And so I saw that as an opportunity. So I would push him a little bit. And when we'd blow everybody else out of the game, the two of us would often be the only ones left, and we would keep raising each other. And he was very competitive, and I saw that, and it led to some hilarious language. But eventually, it was felt that I'd won enough, and they stopped. And with some grumblings, out come these wallets, and money that I never expected came out.
How much did you win, Bruce? Do you remember?
Well, I'm not going to say, but I actually probably had about $20 in my own pocket when I started. So,
but considerably more than that when you stepped off the vessel.
But more when I left. And so, but they were great sports about it, and it was a story we laughed about for years.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. It wasn't long before Bruce Levingston became a regular guest at the dinner parties that William F. Buckley presided over with his wife Pat at their ground floor maisonette on Park Avenue in Manhattan.
The most interesting mixture of people from all kinds of backgrounds, liberals, conservatives, wealthy people, and, you know, writers and artists who had very little. And there was a marvelous sense of adventure at these gatherings. People would have drinks, and he would introduce everyone around. He was an incredibly gracious host. And you really never knew who you were going to meet. I mean, there would often be writers from the National Review, but someone from the New York Times might be there, or from one of the other magazines that had very different points of view. There would be always some kind of music. I played quite often, and particularly before major concerts, it was an opportunity to try out the pieces. And after sumptuous dinner and good wine, Bill would click his glass a little bit, and everything stopped. And he would ask a number of people to speak. And you would stand and talk about something you were interested in or had some area of expertise in. And then guests would often respond to that.
Were you asked to speak, Bruce?
Almost every time he would ask me to speak about something to do with the arts or music.
Bruce, most of us know William F. Buckley for his sort of fiercely political stands. I mean, this man is a modern patriarch of conservatism in America. Did you ever tangle with him? Did he ever take you on or challenge you to a debate? Did you ever find yourselves on opposite sides?
I think we rarely had a serious disagreement. We often, in fact, agreed on the ends we wanted, but would differ on the means. If he disagreed with someone, he would take them on with a great fierceness, but not personally. With me, there was always a kind of gentle banter, and I don't think I ever felt that sharp edge that maybe so many people know him for.
Tell me, if you can, Bruce, about your most memorable evening at Buckley's.
One of them has to do with the "Are You Nervous" line.
Okay. What happened?
I was preparing a very beautiful Beethoven sonata, one of his greatest, to perform at Lincoln Center. It's demanding in every sense.
Bruce practiced diligently. Both he and William Buckley decided that Bruce would preview the piece for guests at the Buckley home sometime before the Lincoln Center performance. Well, shortly before that party, Bruce got a call from Buckley.
And he said, "Oh, Bruce, we're so excited that you're coming to play. We have many wonderful people coming." And in fact, he'd invited an extra 20 people in addition to the 20 that were normally there. That got my attention. And then he said, I've also invited the great Rosalind Hurick. Now, I'd actually heard Rosalind Hurick perform, of course, at Carnegie Hall and other places, but at his home. And it was extraordinary, and she was just a tremendous artist, but also well known as being a somewhat difficult person. And so he said, "Yes, I've invited the great Rosalind Hurick. And you know, Opus 109 was one of her great pieces. She played it incomparably well." And then there was a pause, and he said, "Are you nervous?" And then just broke out laughing. And he said, "I would be." and said, "Well, I'll see you Monday night."
I'd have begged off with a bad cold if I were you.
Then Monday night comes. Now, I've practiced furiously all weekend.
Yeah.
And I go to the house, and I walk in, and Bill's wife, Pat, opens the door, and she said, "I think that was just terrible of him to do that to you." And she takes me in, and the phone rings. It's Rosalind Hurick. She's not feeling well, and so she doesn't come, and Bill comes down the stairs, says, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "Not now." He later confessed to me that he had asked Rosalind Hurick before she performed once if she'd been nervous, and she snapped at him and said, "You should never ask a performer that." So he knew that this was a mischievous thing to do. And so then it just became a line that we used between us, and we would turn and say, "Are you nervous?" And the little glint in his eye, and I knew that that was going to come out. We might be anywhere, and he would just say that, or I would say it to him, and we would laugh.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. The pianist, Bruce Levingston, got to know William F. Buckley Jr. well enough to learn some things about him, and particularly that all of his views weren't as set in stone as some people might believe. On one occasion, Bruce recalls, he was sitting at Buckley's piano, practicing music by a modern French composer, a fellow by the name of Eric Satie. Here's a recording of Bruce Levingston playing Gymnopédie No. 1.
Bill rushed in and said, "What is that? It must be by Bach. I don't know that. It's magnificent." And he just loved it. And when I told him it was by Satie, he just nearly fell over. It was wonderful to see that, you know, he could be moved by this very other kind of music. And he, from then on, had a lifelong affection for Satie. And in fact, we did a performance together in which he read some of Satie's prose poems and I performed some of Satie's works. It's called Spore et Divertissement.
Do you remember the poems that he read?
Satie's poetry is really quite wonderful and very droll and dry and fit Bill's wit and delivery to the T. And so Bill delivered it with just great panache. And he said, "You know, I spoke French before I spoke English."
I was going to ask if he read the poetry in French or in translation.
He mixed it, which was great. But Satie also mixed it.
William F. Buckley Jr. died about 5 weeks ago. He was 82 years old. He's being remembered at a memorial service in New York that will be held tomorrow. His close friend, the acclaimed concert pianist Bruce Levingston, will be among those in attendance. Bruce told me that he last spoke with Buckley just a few days before his death.
We were discussing music, and we were talking about this performance that I was about to give at Carnegie Hall, and I was to play a tryout of the program at his home. And he was very excited about that. He said, "That will be splendid if I'm alive." And he said it playfully. And yet, you know, I think also had a sense that life was fragile and his life was probably at its most fragile. He had not been well. I think maybe he had some inkling that it could happen.
At the memorial service, what will you be thinking about?
Oh, well, I probably will be thinking about the times that we spent together and the private side of Bill, not just the public side. And the public side was remarkable. I think it was amazing that our country had this man that caused us to think and turn ideas around and even, you know, become angry with him about some things that, you know, that the public often did. But I, too, will be thinking about that gentle side that I knew personally and the side, I think, of course, that I'll miss the most. He would write me wonderful letters and emails. And if he ever read anything that appeared in the paper about me, a good review, an article, an interview, he would write saying things that were just so supportive. One in particular that after he read, that it was a review in the New York Times that was written after my All Satie concert. And he said, "I've just read about your remarkable feat, and I wanted to congratulate you. You are something." And he wrote "something" all in caps. And his typing could be hysterically bad, but this he'd obviously taken care to make right. And that was touching. It led me to write him back and tell him how much I had appreciated our friendship over the years. And I'm glad I did that. One of those moments when you stand back and you say to one another, "Look, you know, anything can happen, but I just want to tell you now, I'm glad we've known one another, and I think we did that for each other."
Bruce Levingston joined me from a studio in New York. Yesterday on the program, I talked with Dr. Timothy Quill. Tim is a doctor who specializes in palliative care. He has helped people die, including his own father.
You know, he was so much more peaceful when we had him mildly or moderately sedated than he had been for those weeks beforehand. I mean, it was a different kind of thing. And in fact, he had been asleep for a day or so or a day and a half, hadn't done anything. And he woke up one evening and he was a guy who loved ice cream. So he wanted a little ice cream. So we brought him in a little few tastes of ice cream. And he told my mother that he loved her, you know, which is something that she'll cherish. And then he went back to sleep. And those are the last things he said, really. It was a very peaceful kind of process that he went through.
You're telling me something I didn't expect, that your obligations to him as a son actually, if I understand you, made it easier for you not to be always second-guessing yourself, that what you were doing for him as a doctor and as a son actually came together there.
I think they probably did. I know my dad was ready at that time, that continued living was pretty harsh for him at that time.
After I talked with Timothy Quill, we got a number of letters from you. Brant wrote in to say, and I'm reading it here, "My father just passed away of lung cancer. Our focus changed in the last few days from fighting the cancer to focusing on his comfort. The last 3 days were filled with extreme confusion and suffering for my father. And though I know we were very fortunate compared to others who go through the same for months or longer, we felt that the last few days were not necessary and inhumane. Most importantly, my mother and I felt that it was not a situation that my father would have wanted. We conveyed to the doctors and nurses every chance we got that we would be very appreciative to take advantage of anything that would facilitate the dying process. We were only met with looks as if we were cold, heartless murderers. I really wish," wrote Brant, "we had someone as brave and sensible like Dr. Quill." We always appreciate your mail on the stories that you hear here on the program. The fastest, easiest way to get to me is through our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.